if you're innovating, creating, or making a difference.
This show is for you. Welcome to Over Coffee. I'm Dot Cannon. Here on Over Coffee, we talk with artists and innovators about the process of changing the world in terms of what they do.
It took me a year or two to put Stanley together well, finding the vocal placement of his voice and where to put it in the mouth and all. With Groucho, the placement is in the back of the throat and a little bit nasal, and then the lower register.
Multifaceted actor Jeffrey Weissman proves that hard work and talent can keep a creative career going, but he's certainly not going to tell you it's easy, even with some major movie roles on his resume. Jeffrey has worked with Clint Eastwood, John Lithgow, and, most notably to a lot of his fans, he portrayed George McFly in the second and third installments of the hit movie Back to the Future. While this doesn't seem possible, 2015 is the 30th anniversary of Back to the Future. And in 2015, Jeffrey is constantly working. Just one of the many projects in which he's involved is a Back to the Future commemorative cruise happening in November of this year to benefit Parkinson's research. Jeffrey, what do you remember very best about your growing up years in Los Angeles?
Very best, the excitement of being around people in show business, because my parents often managed or owned private clubs that show business folk would come play cards at or backgammon. And I, at an early age, was cognizant of wanting to be an actor. I remember actually going with my babysitter to one of my dad's clubs and meeting Omar Sharif just before we went to go see him in a film on the screen. And my babysitter kind of flipping out over that. And it was very exciting for me, you know, to meet the movie star and then go see him on the big screen. And that helped, I think, plant early in, because I was very young, I was probably five or under, instill in me a desire to pursue acting. And I, much later on, because I think one of the focuses of your interview was about living history, when I was in junior high, visited the Renaissance Fair and was totally amazed by the total immersion of entertainment mixing with education. And I fell in love instantly with that event. But even before then, I guess even back in grade school, you know, being a bit of the class clown and a ham, and then in junior high, my history teacher allowing me to take whatever time period we were studying and create a faux news report like they used to do on Saturday Night Live, where I would take on a anchorman persona and tell stories and updates of historic events from, say, the Egyptian era, Cleopatra, or whatever we were studying at the time. And so it satisfied a couple different things: my need for being the center of attention and being a ham, class clown, and also getting some education in there as well.
What were the steps for you to actually becoming an actor as you grew up?
Well, I had started getting on stage in community theater at Parks and Recreation in my neighborhood, and then in school, I started doing some, besides variety shows, some plays, and by seventh grade, had managed to land the lead in some big productions at the schools I was at, down in San Diego and then back in Los Angeles. During the summer, would do children's theater and then continue in junior high in the drama class. Then one of the directors from one of the children's theater pieces I did brought me in to play Nick, the kid in A Thousand Clowns at UCLA at McGowan Hall. So finally I was thrown into a situation where there were older actors and a really well-respected drama professor there at UCLA, and I got great encouragement right and left. And then ended up in a production for this director's master's thesis project in a production of Stop the World, I Want to Get Off, where Joyce DeWitt was playing my mother. And I watched Joyce's career take off just a year or two later, and that was very exciting. I had already inserted myself onto sets of location shoots I would find. I found one of the FBI where I was living in about 1968 or 69, and met Efren Zimbalist Jr. and Monty Markham and various people on that set, and got advice from professional actors there. And then a few years later, on my way home from school, I had heard Mel Brooks was shooting a film in my neighborhood in Santa Monica at that time, and eventually saw extras roaming around in Victorian evening wear, and there was one gentleman whose mustache was coming off, and I pointed that out to him, and he thanked me and asked who I was, and I said, well, I'm an actor, and he said, well, what have you done? I mentioned a few of the shows, you know, Merchant of Venice, Dark of the Moon, and such, at my high school and others, and he said, well, would you like to meet Mel? I said, oh, of course. And so he took me to the set of where they were shooting the Putting on the Ritz number at the Mayfair Music Hall there, and got to meet Peter Boyle and Marty Feldman. I was very impressed. Marty Feldman carried a man bag. And Mel, of course, who had no time for me, but nonetheless, it was extremely exciting. And that actor who took me onto that set, who was a professional extra named Roy Wallach, who was good friends with Will Gear and worked regularly, and he sort of mentored me a bit and would take me onto some sets. And it was very exciting getting to meet Will Gear at his Theatricum Botanicum when I was, you know, just 14. It was very inspiring to see the hard work they were doing up there rehearsing their Shakespeare and such.
Of the advice that you received and from what people said to you when you met Marty Feldman, Will Gear, what stayed with you in your later career as an actor?
These stories. Just really being in their aura. One character actor on that set from the FBI had asked to see my report card because it had just come out, and I had mentioned that I had my report card with me, and he looked at it and went through it with me. And I had not done well in math. I think I had a D in math, and he said, you got to be better at math. How are you going to know if your agent's cheating you or not?
That's great. From there, was it your mentor who got you onto the sets of The Rose, for example, as an extra?
No, though I did want desperately to get on movie sets when I didn't, you know, do much else with Roy getting me on to sets and such. I wanted to start working and earning a little money, not just, you know, visiting sets. And at that time, there was a company, something Hollywood Casting. It was basically a paid service that would find you extra work. And I know it was ultimately not that rewarding being an extra. Especially nowadays, there's this huge class divide, and it's just really kind of being part of cattle that is being herded often. Anyway, I wanted to be on the set of anything just to get my foot in the door, get my feet wet. And I think I paid $90 to be a part of the service. And I was sent out to different sets. And that's how I got on The Rose with Bette Midler. And I remember Norton Buffalo wore my hat in one scene that we were shooting, which I was very proud of my cap, that my cap became a principal. The show FM was the name of one film with Martin Mull and Eileen Brennan. That was really exciting to be on the Universal backlot for that. And then over at MGM, I got on Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band with Peter Frampton and the Bee Gees. And I played about four different characters in that. The girlfriend to Peter Frampton's character, Strawberry Fields, I played her brother in the scene where she takes off in the balloon, and got to be in the Earth, Wind & Fire crowd scene. And then I got asked to do these dance steps as a sort of brainwashed Boy Scout in the scene with Alice Cooper. And I got several days on that and got to do some dance moves, which upgraded me to finally being on a SAG eligibility contract. Now, from going from a waiver extra to being eligible to join the union was a pretty big step in 1977 for me. So at the time, and people who know how much it costs to join SAG now, which is probably about, I don't know, $3,600 or more. At that time, it was $350 to join SAG. And I was still a struggling student, teenager, and I was like, oh my, I either can join the Screen Actors Guild now or I can pay my rent. Which will I do? And needless to say, I had to pay my rent. And it wasn't for many years later that I actually joined the Screen Actors Guild. And at that time, I think by the time I joined in 82, it had gone up to $750 or $1,000. But I, you know, sort of was spinning wheels. I was on some sets, but I wasn't getting any meaty parts. I was doing some stage work and work here and there through Living History stuff. And I think it was Gordon Davidson down at the Dorothy Chandler Pavilion, or Gordon Hunt, one of the Gordons, looked at my resume at an audition for a Neil Simon play, I remember, downtown, and he said, you know, you've got talent, but I don't think anyone's going to hire you unless you get some really good training. And so I asked him, what do you recommend? And he said, well, go to an Ivy League school, go to Juilliard. I said, well, what's here on the West Coast? Because I didn't have a lot of resources. My grades weren't the best, and my folks weren't very anxious about supporting me necessarily at that time as an actor. And he said, well, you know, here on the West Coast, the American Conservatory Theater is good. And so I actually set my sights and auditioned for ACT. My first time around, I didn't get accepted, but Alan Fletcher, I remember at the time, said, you've got talent, and if you don't get in, keep trying, because you really have your age working against you. And I was still, you know, 17 or 18. And I just pursued it, and I kept doing shows at the Renaissance Fair. By this time, I had written shows for them. I played Christopher Marlowe. I'd done some sword English country dancing, lots of fun little silly shows that I put together with other performers in the streets there, playing Elizabethan English village characters, and eventually moved north with the Renaissance Fair and lived on their property for a few months while doing shows in San Francisco and eventually getting back into the audition process for ACT and got accepted in about 1981.
And from there, what happened for you?
I went into their advanced training program and made very good friends with faculty and had a blast. I worked, of course, my tail off from 6 a.m. to 6 p.m. every day and then rehearsing at night, and I just loved it. I could not get enough of it. Everything from yoga and Alexander technique to jazz and tap and sword fighting, stage combat and scene study, and just a really comprehensive, well-rounded kind of training. And unfortunately, one of the lead instructors there, I did not really care for the way he treated actresses. I felt really a kind of a creepy vibe, a bit of a misogynist attitude. And I went to the head of the conservatory, who loved my work. And I said, you know, this guy, I'm going to butt heads with him. I can see it. It's not going to. And he said, well, take your intermediate training over somewhere else, like at San Francisco State University, and then come back to us because I want you in the advanced program. And at that time, Annette Bening was there, and it was really a lot of fantastic talent. And I went to San Francisco State during this 1 year of intermediate studies. And while I was going to State University, I fell into an opportunity to be seen by a casting folk from Los Angeles who were looking for a lead young actor for a major motion picture for MGM. And then United Artists then also merged with them at about that time.
And what was that lead?
It turned out it was a director by the name of Martin Brest, who had directed Tough Guys. He made a name with a film that he had, I think it was Jeff Corey and Art Carney, and this was his first really big budget Hollywood film. It was called The Genius when I came onto it, and Warren Oates was attached to it. During this period, while I was being considered for the role, an agent pursued me and said that she knew Martin Brest from New York, where she worked for William Morris, and he had really talked me up to her, and she pursued signing me so she could handle my contract because I was set for doing a screen test. This open call, this cattle call I went on to basically keep a friend company because I thought he was right for it. And out of these open calls that MGM had for The Genius in Seattle and Los Angeles, New York, Chicago, about five cities, I think I was the only one who got a screen test from it. So the day I finally tested, the film almost didn't get made because Warren Oates died, and when the mergers of UA-MGM happened, the film went into turnaround where it loses its backing pretty much, but somehow it got back on track. Martin Brest was still interested in having me screen test, and the day I tested, they also looked at Eric Stoltz and Dana Carvey, Brian Backer, who had just won a Tony Award on Broadway, and some other young talent. And we all tested with Ali Sheedy, and they changed the name of the film to War Games. And needless to say, none of us got it. Matthew Broderick ended up getting the role. And the director, Martin, who wanted me, was released from the project a couple weeks into shooting. And John Badham came in and finished directing it.
Wow. Wow. And it seems like so far the theme has been very close, but not quite. How do you keep going as an actor when you've come that close and get that many disappointments?
Well, that was the huge turning point for me in that when I signed with that agent, she insisted I had to move back to Los Angeles. Now, I had fallen in love with the San Francisco Bay Area. I just found I could finally be my kind of quirky, strange self and not be so self-conscious. In Los Angeles, there's always this pressure of you're under scrutiny. You know, everyone wants to be a star. There's a game being played here. Whereas in San Francisco, it's much less that feel, especially during the late 70s, early 80s. And I had to forego going back into the advanced program at ACT and move to Los Angeles and continue my studies at City College in Santa Monica and elsewhere. But I had also sort of shot myself in the foot by telling everyone I knew that I thought it was in the bag, that I had this part. So my ego also did a tailspin. You know, the adage, you know, don't tell anyone until it's finally on the screen. You know, you'll end up on the cutting room floor or, you know, big project. You don't share them. And I learned that lesson the hard way of several months of just being rather embarrassed about that whole thing. And it took me a while to get over first the disappointment, but then also see how Hollywood really works. They don't want to cast you unless you have numerous things, training, some credits, and connections that will vouch for you. And I got into a lot of casting offices during that period because I was a hot item in casting for the lead in this film. But I really never got cast in anything for about 3 months. And it was a pretty rough summer, parking cars and bussing tables and then getting cooking jobs. But in the fall, I landed a nice little co-star support role in Twilight Zone movie, which surprised me that they were even finishing the film because the terrible accident on John Landis's segment had already taken place. And I was like, I'm really going to finish this film, but apparently Spielberg decided he wanted to. And I met with the Australian director, George Miller, who was famous for directing the Mad Max movie. And this was his first Hollywood project. And we got along really well. He's a sweet man and lots of fun. And he liked me, so he cast me to be in that segment on the airplane with John Lithgow, the remake of Nightmare at 30,000 Feet. So I finally got my first little co-star role in the segment of that Twilight Zone movie, and then worked next with Louis Malle on his film Crackers, and the scene with Sean Penn that made it to the cutting room floor. I think you've seen me very briefly in that. And then a little bit in Johnny Dangerously with Michael Keaton, not too long after that.
What's your favorite story from going back to Twilight Zone, the movie, and Nightmare at 30,000 Feet, from working, if I remember correctly, as the young man sitting across the aisle from John Lithgow?
That's right. Young Newlywed. Young Newlywed was the official name of the character. And John was very sweet, but George was really great in that he said if there are bits or lines that you feel might be appropriate here, because it wasn't all fleshed out in the script, let's try them during a rehearsal, he would say. And I came up with a handful of lines and little bits of business, and a few of those remained in the film. Very quick, though. The excitement for me on being on that set, also, besides this great ensemble, really put some lovely people together, J.D. Johnson and Donna Dixon and Abby Lane, Charles Knapp, and, of course, John leading the way. There was great camaraderie, and also there was a gentleman, a very tall gentleman named Garrett Brown, who was the, I guess, second cinematographer on that, who was using his newly developed Steadicam. And Alan Davio, who had shot E.T., was the main cinematographer. But for the Steadicam work, which is all those shots that are very quick shots running up and down the aisles of the plane, were done by this man carrying this, I think at that time it was like a 65-pound camera and pack on his shoulders that was able to move side to side and run very quickly down an aisle. It finally gave the camera a lot of freedom. And as anyone in the industry knows now, the Steadicam is just invaluable to today's shoots. So that was exciting because I was fascinated also by the technology being on set. I remember just almost every set that I go on just being really fascinated with playback operators. The Twilight Zone also, for the first time, remember George Miller being giddy, because for the first time they were able to put a tap into the lens and he could see playback. Before this, and that was 1982, directors had to trust what was going into the camera and see in dailies what they had captured, whereas now they had a video monitor tap where he could see what the lens was seeing.
Which is true, we take so much for granted today, where you instantly take it and instantly look back at it. That was a bulky process back then.
Yes, and it was very exciting for a director to be able to finally see, you know, they once in a while can look through the lens, generally leave it and trust their cinematographer, but now he could see what the cameraman is seeing and make adjustments live in the moment.
Work on various other projects, including Scarecrow and Mrs. King, would follow Jeffrey's appearance in that 1982 Twilight Zone movie. And then,
about 86, 87, I started working at Universal Studios. I was in between film and TV roles. And ironically, in 86, I got a part in a commercial that had a Back to the Future theme to it. And I got cast as a 50s greaser when this guy, sort of a Marty McFly, takes his DeLorean time machine back to the past and discovers Cherry Coke. That was kind of fun. But I was working at Universal Studios playing characters on their tour. I played Stan Laurel, was their number one Laurel and Hardy team, with a gentleman named Beavis Faversham. And we're still available for playing Laurel and Hardy. If anyone hears this and has an event they want to go Laurel and Hardy at. And I also played Charlie Chaplin, warming up the Western Stunt Show, and Groucho Marx. I put these characters together over the years, trying to do my best to honor them and do accurate representations, keeping integrity and such with costuming and interpretation and vocal work and so on and so forth. And it really was fantastic for me to be recognized and greet people from around the world every day. I learned to greet in 15 different languages because everyone, almost everyone from China and India to, you know, most of the world know these characters. And so they would immediately have to have a photo with us. And if you could greet in their languages, they'd love you even more. It was really a lovely gift having that job.
When you're doing Chaplin, when you're doing Groucho Marx, what do you find are the things that you have to remember to honor that person that maybe most actors don't do?
Well, you know, it's a great question. There's, in doing the environmental theater, I call it, like those Renaissance fairs and the Charles Dickens Christmas fair, I learned that, you know, it's more than theater in the round. You're totally immersed, and physicalities and characters, little habits and costumes and props, there's a relationship with all of it. It can be overwhelming. You're constantly on, and often for many hours at a time. And becoming second nature with quirks or mannerisms is very important. Knowing the history of the characters, often I could create my own characters and create my own history, but then when playing, say, Christopher Marlowe back in the late 70s, I learned to take on a lot of his history and try to incorporate that as well as his writings and poetry. And that sort of carried over when I first applied and auditioned to be Stan Laurel. I sure had seen Laurel and Hardy, but I didn't really retain much. And I was doing things completely wrong on my audition for The Big Boss. But the gentleman who played Oliver Hardy knew my work from a show. I played Mercutio in a production of Romeo and Juliet. And he knew my work, and he said, this guy's got talent, let me train him and get him in shape, which he did. I sort of got mentored by this gentleman, Beavis, who took me under his wing, and I found that he was a font of knowledge and also a genius at creating bits and new knockabout and slapstick humor. And so I then became blinded by the genius of Stan Laurel. You know, I don't know if a lot of people know, but he often wrote many of the bits and scenes that Laurel and Hardy did in their films. He also often edited the films. He directed a lot. And he was just a genius from his early life. He was brought up in show business. His father was a famous producer in music hall in England. And so he was raised around talents like Dan Leno and Little Titch, you know, these legends of the music hall stage. And he borrowed from the greats, in fact, that silly smile that Stanley has, that sort of, I want to say, naive or dumb smile that he's so famous for and scratching his head, that look comes from a performer named Dan Leno. You see pictures of Dan Leno with that same face. So you know where Stanley got it. You know, the imitation is a form of flattery. People, there's nothing original. All these catchphrases are based in reality. There really is very little that's original. But if you're going to put something together, borrow from the greats. You see the Three Stooges or Abbott and Costello, they all used bits and routines that were others, that were ancient from the early vaudeville stages, Niagara Falls and Flugel Street, that those guys had made famous, Who's on First, etc. Those were not their routines. They had borrowed those from other comedy teams and made them famous because they were the first to do them on film. So every time I discover, it took me a year or two to put Stanley together well, finding the vocal placement of his voice and where to put it in the mouth and all. And then his catchphrases like, you don't believe me, or time flies like an arrow and fruit flies like a banana. You know, I'm not quite warmed up here, but eventually I would see these other performers who were actually higher on the roster than I was, playing Charlie Chaplin or Groucho Marx, and they were embarrassing to me, and it kind of pained me when I'd learn more about Charlie or learn more about Groucho. I already was a huge fan of both those, but I didn't really dive in to get the essence of them and how to portray them and read their life histories and then try to do service to them by upgrading my performance and everyone else along the way. When I came on the scene, the gentleman who was doing the portrayal of Charlie Chaplin was wearing shorts and no makeup and a bad mustache and a terrible hat and a lousy cane. And I, you know, put my Charlie together, and he immediately was like, uh-oh, I'm being threatened. And he got together and bumped up his game and got the right kind of costume and started wearing makeup and bring it right. And that felt great because I was here being a catalyst for improving everyone's game. And that's the type of thing I love doing, just the team kind of thing. And this way it was, I hate to say it was antagonistic, but it inspired people to raise the bar. And did that with Groucho. And when I start getting work as these characters, sometimes it was for the families of the originals. I did a big $1,000 plate fundraiser for a charity, and it was honoring Robert Marx and his wife Gilda. And my Marx Brothers team was the center attraction, sort of this stage show that we did with Bill Marx, Harpo's son, and Robert's grandson. And then this would Groucho's great-nephew in the show with us. And at the end of the show, Robert came up to me and said I was the best Groucho he had seen. And that, I remember I had a terrible fever and cold that night at the performance, and I just went wild. I was so thrilled to get that kind of feedback from the family.
Jeffrey talked about some of the techniques that enabled him to create the character of Groucho so faithfully.
With Groucho, the placement is in the back of the throat and a little bit nasal, and then the lower register. So you can hear how I'm manipulating my voice and throat and all. It doesn't come overnight. It takes a lot of playback and listening. And using those talents, I was able to also, you know, do the George McFly impression, which they needed to recreate those scenes in Back to the Future 2 and 3.
That role came up for Jeffrey during his time at Universal.
I got a call about being just a photo double stand-in for Crispin Glover, who I had worked with before. In fact, the year before he got the first Back to the Future movie, I had done a film at the American Film Institute with him and Dan O'Herlihy. So I knew this actor's work, and I thought he was fascinating, and I was very proud of him when I saw the first Back to the Future movie. I thought he did a knockout job as George McFly. So this opportunity came to me first as a stand-in photo double, and then I guess they were still in negotiations with him during this period, and I went through the audition process, and I also had makeup prosthetics fitted for me and body cast for special effects and such, and did a screen test. And Dean Cundey, the cinematographer, and Robert Zemeckis, the director, decided that they could work with me. And then I learned that the contract with Crispin didn't go well. The negotiations didn't work out. He wanted the same money as Michael J. Fox and script approval or this and that, and they weren't going to allow that. And so Spielberg and company decided to go with just me and a few quick cuts from the first film, which later I learned Crispin didn't give them permission to reuse his likeness. And so it turned into a legal thing with the Screen Actors Guild eventually making it a rule that you can't make an actor look like another actor without that actor's permission, which is lovely, needed to be in place. But unfortunately, there was sort of an ugly legal thing that went on, and they settled with Crispin out of court.
In fact, our listeners are not going to forgive us here if we don't cover a couple of your favorite stories when you were portraying George McFly. What were some of your favorite experiences when you were George McFly in Back to the Future 2?
I think my favorite experience was just being in that incredible environment on the set with the incredible team of talent that Zemeckis had assembled. The great comedic timing that first is there inherent in the script that Bob and Bob wrote, and then the great talent from Tom Wilson and Leah Thompson to Michael J. Fox. It, for me, I'm always observing and trying to catch technique. When I worked with Clint Eastwood on Pale Rider, the Western that I co-starred with him in 85, I watched Clint's technique on working in front of the camera. He put everything at the end of his nose, and while we're shooting with him, it looks like he's not doing anything at all. And yet when it's 70 feet across on the big screen, it's full. It's really fantastic. It's a very internal type of process. When working with John Lithgow on Twilight Zone movie, John, who is weaned on stage, is huge, and he's a big man already. And his work for that, especially that very hyper and emotional character, is fully charged. He has to sort of rein it in, but it's still big, and yet it's completely connected to his truth and his core, and that's why it worked. Otherwise, it would be way too big for anyone, especially on the big screen. But it was great. It was external working in. Clint was internal working solid from the core and with extreme close-ups, and so it's full. And then watching Michael J. Fox on Back to the Future, watching his work was just completely different from those two other actors I'm mentioning, where Michael was sort of weaned on his TV show, you know, Family Ties. He was shooting Family Ties all during the day last season while shooting with us all night. And I would say, Michael, when do you sleep? And he'd say, you know, in the limousine on the way to and from the studio. I was like, oh my God. Poor man. Listening to him, watching him work and put his formula together, that formula he honed on the TV show, was just wonderful. And he knew when it wasn't working. In fact, sometimes when Zemeckis thought he got a take, Michael would say, can I do it again? I didn't feel like it was connected or it was real or I could do better. And he had developed that, you know, outside eye that was reining and watching and keeping him in check, knowing if it's truthful or not, or if his angle or relationship with the camera was off. He has honed that sense, that extra sense. And that is so key for an actor that wants to, you know, work in front of the lens. It was really remarkable to see him and his formula, his craft.
Jeffrey also addressed a question that may well have been on a lot of moviegoers' minds. How do you deal with hanging upside down for 20 hours on a set?
Well, you know, it was a pain in the back. I had a lot of support there. The wonderful special effects crew from ILM had built a little board on a ladder so I didn't have to get down in between takes all the time, but they at least let me rest my back. And, you know, the excitement of being on that set and part of that creative process was a driving factor, and the pretty good money I was making was another factor. You know, I think they eventually bought me a massage or two to help my back, you know. You know, all that was also meant as, I think, torture for Crispin, because he had been such a pain on the first film. Being eccentric and neurotic and demanding.
One more lesson for actors. Never give grief on a set or you may hang upside down.
Yeah, there you go.
What else do you tell your students when you talk about acting and surviving as an actor?
To diversify, to be versatile, be flexible. If you have blinders on, you're going to shoot yourself in the foot. It's an extremely hard vocation to make a living at. And you've heard what I've done. I've done voice work on films. I was in a loop group for a while that worked on a lot of big films and TV shows, doing voices. I've modeled, I've done trade shows, been an artist's reference for animations. I've done motion capture. have done what they call guerrilla theater in the commercial world, playing characters on the streets for ad campaigns. You know, just being versatile, because it's all showbiz. It's all related. It may not pay or be as great as being on a movie set or a television show shoot, but it is something. Industrials, almost every big company needs actors to be in these industrial films that will show protocol for human resources or developing new products or breakthroughs or communications for IT. You know, many departments of these big companies need these little in-house movies. Often also there's product films that need to be shown at trade shows that are introducing a new product or demonstrating. I mean, they need actors for those. There's hospitals that will use actors in these trials to teach doctors and nurses how to deal with patients with certain conditions. And that's role-playing stuff, animation voices. There's a lot of different opportunities out there if you're flexible and you stay open to those things. The hard part, though, is to be ready to rock in all of those. And often clients and agents and casting directors will put blinders on and not know you unless you tell them that that's the kind of work that you do. I've had very fortunate jobs thrown my way where I've been called by my commercial agent to work at a live gig for a large public relations firm or production house to honor, say, a CEO, where they would have never known that I could do that event for them had I not told them I do these characters like Laurel and Hardy or Keystone Cop or whatever. Thus, I get an extra gig out of it rather than just a commercial or commercial audition. So you need to have communication grade. I tell all this, the business part of my teaching, so the business of acting. You have to market yourself, see yourself as a product. You can't see auditions as a competition. As soon as you look at it as a competition, you're draining your energy. You have to just go in and celebrate and be you and uniquely you and be your best and stay focused and have a strong core, constantly work on your craft, and then be your own advocate by keeping your marketing together. If you change your hair color or your hairstyle, you need to update your photos. You need to constantly update your resume. You need to constantly be in touch with your business team, your agent, your manager, your publicist. And then there's social networking. I recommend that all my students keep two journals, one for their craft while they're working on a show, you know, about their character and everything that goes into their technique, whether it's on camera, on stage, or environmental. And then another journal for business, who you met, where and how, and if you can, get their contact info so you can stay in touch. Because if you've found that someone has inspired you, that you're working well on someone, even if it's a grad student thesis film, and they're very focused, they're eventually going to make it. And you want to stay in touch with them so you can be there and on their team and, you know, sort of stay in their realm, because hopefully they're going to find other work for you down the road. I worked with people like Greg Araki, who's a big cult director on his thesis project. His cinematographer on that, I remember, was John Schwartzman, who's a huge cinematographer now. Catherine Hardwick helped her with an early fun project that she had right out of college. And she's gone on to being a huge director with the Twilight series and Lords of Dogtown and 13 great movies. And then Lawrence Bender, who is Quentin Tarantino's, one of his main producers, was in acting class with him. You know, you never know what the path that the people around you are going to take, but if you see that they are successful and you're able to stay in touch, and now it's pretty easy through social networking or Twitter or what have you, Facebook, to do that, and it's great. I unfortunately didn't take this advice early on. I should be able to call Michael J. Fox or, you know, John Lithgow, people who I really got along with and worked well with on set, but I didn't take the time to ask them, can I call you at home? Can I have your personal address so I can drop you a card once in a while? Because I, of course, thought my agent, I would always have this great agent and that she would take care of everything for me. So I kind of shot myself in the foot there, and I used myself as a lesson there for my students.
But talent and determination have kept him working.
I'm always trying to develop something. I've got a couple projects I'm on hold for, a couple of independent films, and not able to talk about them because they're in pre-production and, you know, kind of assigned to secrecy on those. I have one film that is doing a festival circuit now, making the rounds, kind of called Savior of None. It's a very heavy film, drama and tragedy, where I play a widower, epileptic, depressed man who takes a young adolescent girl who's being abused in the foster care system under his wing, and he eventually becomes her avenging angel from all the abuse she endures. And that film has been getting the right responses from audiences. The last festival I saw it in, when the lights came up, there wasn't a dry eye in the house, so that was really lovely. There's a film that's going to be coming back to streaming. It has been sort of changing hands, and now I believe the filmmakers are going to be getting it back up on Amazon to streaming again. A very fun comedy I'm in called Porked, which is a mockumentary a la Christopher Guest movies, where I play an obsessive compulsive winemaker, and it's about life in the winemaking world. And it's a hoot. It's a real fun romp. There's one that is still looking to get finished here in post, where I play Mark Twain. Mark Twain's Adventures in the Holy Land, where I went to Israel and Los Angeles and San Francisco to shoot, playing Mark Twain in 1867 on his trip to Europe on the first commercial cruise line. And that was very exciting, shooting in Jerusalem as Mark Twain. And I've also continued playing Mark Twain live. I'll play him for history foundations and museums. There's a time travel weekend up in Old Sacramento that I've been playing Twain for, among other characters, like Old Medicine Man. And so that's been very rewarding, and I'm trying to develop a one-man Twain show, not like Hal Holbrook's older Twain, but rather the younger and more middle-aged Twain, and the show deals with his shadow life. He had a lot of great tragedies in his life, so I'm currently writing and developing that show.
Would you keep me posted when that comes out? Our listeners will love to hear about that.
I will, absolutely.
I would love to know, before we have to wrap up, a little bit about the cruise with which you're involved and also your Just for Laughs show at Ohio State University.
Oh, wonderful. Yes, I was contacted, first of all, address the last one first. Dennis Free, who is a great, wonderful gentleman out of Long Beach, went to Ohio State, and he, with a bunch of his buddies, created a comedy group called The Esoterics that sang and did comedy sketches. And they actually had some success. They played Carnegie Hall. They were part of the Shindig there in the early 60s. And so for a 50-year reunion, they decided to do a show first for the Fringe Festival in San Francisco, and then we took it a couple of years later to Ohio State to establish a scholarship program for the theater department there. And we've revived it a few times, where it's comedy, magic, and song and dance, and various guests plug into the show. And it's just a lovely, especially for me, Dennis found me online and thought I might be right for the show because of the different characters I can play. And I've done some magic. I had my Laurel and Hardy team do a magic show that we took to the South China Sea aboard a cruise ship there a couple times. So I was able to learn the show, and I can sing and dance. A couple of years ago, I even played Igor in Mel Brooks' musical version of Young Frankenstein and got nominated for my work in that for a Critics Award. And, you know, singing and dancing, which is not my number one, I worked my tail off and hung in there. It was in 9 different numbers in that show. So it's important, you know, this is advice for talent out there that are listening to this besides the business. Keep working on your craft and expanding yourself. Take lessons in singing, take lessons in dancing, no matter how much you think you can't. The opportunity is going to come where people are going to need you to or expect you to. So at least, you know, fake it till you make it. And so getting back to the other question of the cruise, because, you know, my career kind of stalled after I lost that really great agent after the Clint Eastwood movie. I kind of treading water, even though I worked on For the Boys and a few other projects, Diagnosis Murder and Saved by the Bell and such. I didn't really get the clout I had with the power agent I had. She was, even though she was a boutique agent, she had a lot of nerve and power and negotiated great money and opportunities for me. And that kind of washed up until the Back to the Future opportunity came. And that has been very good to me in that I've had a fan base from around the world seek me out to come to Comic Cons. I'm in fact going to London Comic Con this summer and various other cast reunion events celebrating the 30th anniversary. And because those films have been pretty good to me, not necessarily monetarily wise, but more for just the praise from the fans and the attention. And, you know, I'm a legend in my own mind. I get to be, you know, the celebrity when I go to these things. I felt it was time to do something that both gave back to the fans and also to help support Michael J. Fox Parkinson's Research Foundation. So I'm putting together a cruise in the Caribbean for this coming November for a week, where we're going from Fort Lauderdale to a private island off Haiti to Jamaica and to Cozumel. And I'm getting as many of the cast and crew members that I can who want to come along to sail. And we'll recreate the Enchantment Under the Sea dance on the ship, where I've got Harry Waters Jr., who played Marvin Berry, you know, Chuck Berry's cousin, who sang Earth Angel and Night Train and such. He headed the band in the movies. He's going to be heading our band. And I've got Don Fullalove, who played Goldie Wilson, the mayor, on bass, and Mark McClure probably on drums or guitar, and me on guitar. And, you know, if Michael J. Fox shows up, he can play his Johnny B. Goode lead. And, you know, I've got a lot of wishes that who knows if it'll come true. I've only sold so far, I think, 30 passages. And I need to get at least 100 to probably make any kind of profit for the Parkinson's Foundation. But I have faith. And it's very exciting because it'll be a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity for a fan. And then a great opportunity to give back, because everyone really loves Michael. And it's heartbreaking to see his condition deteriorate with his Parkinson's. And my father's best friend, when my dad's Alzheimer's and dementia was kicking in, his best friend had Parkinson's. And they were quite a team. They would do drama together and hang out together. It was really lovely. And another dear friend of mine has the terminal version of Parkinson's. And so this is a way to try to, you know, look for a cure while having a great time while doing it.
Let's give out the website where people can find out more about that cruise, because we all know somebody who's touched by Parkinson's.
Yeah, it's www.bttfcruise.com is the easiest one. That's BTTF, Back to the Future. BTTFcruise.com or the cruisetoendparkinsons.com. There's a number of different ways you can find that website. And the Back to the Future fan club, the time travel terminal, or backtothefuture.com, there's a lot of different ways to find links to the cruise. They're a big supporter of ours. Stephen Clark with the Back to the Future fan club is just this gem of a man out of Alabama who's got a whole website that is dedicated to everything Back to the Future. So all the events for the 30th anniversary will be there. Also on Team Fox, they're going to be coming out on their blog probably by the time this airs of all the activities. There are other events like the We're Going Back, which is another fundraiser for the Parkinson's Foundation, where Ken Kapalowski out of Canada and his partners are going to go to all the locations that the Back to the Future movies used around Los Angeles and elsewhere and have events with the original actors, stunt people, and crew folk who were a part of those shoots. So if you want to be a part of another very exciting event, that's going to take place in the latter part of October. And that event is called We're Going Back, WeGoingBack.com.
WeGoingBack.com. This is going to be an exciting celebration on both of these, the cruise and the We're Going Back.
Yeah, yes. And then, like I mentioned, London Comic Con coming up in July has a cast reunion going on that I know Chris Lloyd and Leah Thompson are already a part of, and I'm going to be snuck in there at the last minute, I think.
It's going to be a blast. Jeffrey, as we conclude here, what do you most want people to learn from you and your experience as a theater professional about creativity, innovation, and making a difference?
I am a huge advocate of exposing yourself to the arts and storytelling and technique. I see a lot of teachers say, you know, this is the only technique you need. Come study with me and do nothing else, and sort of it upsets me to see sometimes students bang their heads against the wall and not make the breakthroughs that they could probably very easily if they expose themselves to other masters. There's maybe 10 really great masters of acting technique out there, and I think students need to expose themselves to those techniques to find what really works for them. I have studied several different techniques and have found useful parts of different ones. Subjective personalization, you know, Meisner or action technique or viewpoints, you know, Stella Adler's or Michael Chekhov. I think an actor needs to expose themselves to the techniques and then train. And I would hope they would. And then write their own stories or write the stories that are potent to them and dance, sing, and act them out, act those stories out, because Hollywood is kind of this machine that it's extremely difficult, first of all, to get an agent and then to get to be a union member because you have to get the role. And it's almost a closed kind of machine. And to crack that nut to get in there is very difficult. And a lot of actors, Steve Buscemi, Billy Bob Thornton, you know, have made their own name by often doing indie projects or writing and creating their own projects. And if you have a heartfelt project, people will pick up on that. And technology of shooting, you know, with the advent of Red Camera or, you know, digital format, everyone and their mother can make a movie now if they're really dedicated, because it's affordable and accessible. And there are a lot of filmmakers out there that want to work. So you could put your own project together. The thing is, develop your writing skills or work with a writer and tell your stories, tell your heartfelt stories, make your own project. That way you have something to show when an agent or a producer or a studio wants to see what you can do or what you've got. Then you can strut yourself through your stuff, and that's a big wow factor, and that'll open a lot more doors. I always say to my students, you know, you're an overnight success generally takes about 20 years. You can cut it in half with your business savvy and your drive, and also your heart. I've met actors who've come to Hollywood with nothing, no resources, but their heart was driving them, and their insanity often was driving them, and they become extremely successful in a very short period of time because they were so focused and, you know, they had their core really in it. And believe me, there are so many scams and folk out there who unfortunately take advantage of the dream machine and will exploit young talent, and you've got to have your eyes open and be realistic about it and practical. If you're blinded by dreams and are taken in, you can get hurt, and I've seen it all too often. I've seen people who take criticisms personally and just derail their careers when they should never have denied their talent. I've seen young talents who are not trained who shoot themselves in the foot because they're not prepared when opportunity knocks to really rock and do their best. Or, you know, those who don't stay focused and derail themselves because they've scattered themselves too much or got wrapped up in fear. So there's a lot of elements there I'm covering.
Jeffrey, thank you for your time today.
Oh, Don, it's been a real pleasure. I'm so happy that you asked me to come on.
You and I have been listening to actor, writer, director, and acting teacher Jeffrey Weissman. You'll find more information on Jeffrey's current projects on his website, jeffreyweissman.com. That's jeffreyweissman.com. And you'll find details on the Back to the Future cruise Jeffrey mentioned, which benefits Parkinson's research and which will be leaving in November of this year, on bttfcruise.com. That's BTTF, as in Back to the Future, cruise.com. bttfcruise.com.
And that concludes this edition of Over Coffee. Thank you for listening. If you'd like to hear more Over Coffee podcasts, our link is twomaverix.com. That's twomaverix.com. And you can contact us at twomaverix@gmail.com. The music you're hearing is royalty-free production music provided by Pond5 at pond5.com. I'm Dot Cannon. Here's wishing you a cappuccino day.